This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. As the Obama administration and Congress work to revive the economy, they're also beginning to consider reforms aimed at making the financial system less vulnerable to the chaos that gripped the country over the past year. High on the agenda is the regulation of derivatives, those complex financial instruments that have brought big profits and dangerous volatility to financial markets. Among the most troubling of the derivatives are credit default swaps. They're a kind of insurance policy on bonds. Tens of trillions of dollars worth of credit default swaps were sold in recent years. They've escaped regulation due to laws passed in the 1990s and at the end of 2000. Thus, financial institutions that sell these swaps don't have to report what they've sold or who they've sold them to. They also don't have to have the money on hand to pay off the contracts should the insured bonds fail. When AIG was unable to make good on credit default swaps it issued on mortgage-backed bonds, it had to be bailed out with $170 billion of taxpayers' money. The Obama administration sent a letter to Congress a month ago proposing new regulations for derivatives. And banks, many of which got billions of dollars in federal bailout money, have hired lobbyists to resist new controls. For some insight into the debate, we turn to Gretchen Morgenson. She's a financial and business columnist for The New York Times. Well, Gretchen Morgenson, welcome back to Fresh Air. Okay, so the Obama administration indicated several weeks ago that it wanted to regulate derivatives. The Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, wrote a letter to the Senate Majority Leader and others. And there have been other expressions by the administration of its plans. What do they want to do?
Well, what I would characterize the letter that Mr. Geithner sent to Capitol Hill as is sort of a halfway step. They want to try to get a lot more of these kinds of contracts to be traded on an exchange or some type of clearinghouse where they could be overseen by a regulator. The difficulty is that many of the contracts are very highly specific and written with the particular entities who are striking the deal in mind, meaning that they're not sort of plain vanilla. They're not sort of white bread, everyday contracts. They might have a particular aspect of them that's highly unusual, and it's related only to the entity that's buying the insurance. And those cannot be traded as easily as, say, 100 shares of IBM, these people say. And so the halfway aspect of this proposal is that those kinds of hand-tailored or highly specific credit default swaps will not see the light of day. They will continue to be traded privately. And those were the very contracts that AIG wrote and that got AIG into trouble.
That sounds very problematic.
Well, it just sounds like there are going to be ways for dealers and market participants to sort of say, oh, well, this is one of those hand-tailored ones. It can't possibly trade on an exchange or a clearinghouse, and sort of keep a lot of the market away from the scrutiny that I think it really deserves and merits. And so you have to wonder who's going to be making those decisions about which contracts actually do see the light of day.
Okay, so there's also the issue of when a company decides to write a credit default swap contract, in other words, to commit to pay in the event of a default by someone. Don't investors need to know whether in the end they will have the financial reserves to meet that obligation if indeed the default occurs? Does the Obama administration propose reserve requirements so that people who are making these commitments, are we going to be assured that they have the financial means to fulfill them?
They will require what is called margin, and that is similar to, as you describe it, Dave, a reserve. What that is that's money that is required to be put up when the transaction occurs to satisfy, the participants' fears, as you point out, that maybe the person writing the insurance will not have the money, necessary to pay off if a default does occur. But you bring up a good point, which is there is a difference between exchanges and clearinghouses. The Treasury has proposed more of a, that this market go in the direction of a clearinghouse. It has not required that these things be traded on an exchange, which is far more transparent. And, you know, we all know how exchanges work, and they've been around for hundreds of years, and they actually work pretty well. But the clearinghouse, in my view, which the Treasury has sort of proposed a little bit more strongly, has some problems associated with it that go to the heart of what you're talking about, which is, you know, who will be on the hook and will they be money good when the time comes. A clearinghouse relies on a central intermediary, a clearing party, as it were. So I am a customer. Let's say I'm buying insurance from a bank. If I worked this trade on a clearinghouse, then I would work with an intermediary. And the intermediary is sort of that entity for that period of time anyway that has to be money good. And so you do add an element of concern there that there's another party involved that would also have to be overseen and regulated quite closely to make sure that, you know, if there were major defaults or a cascade of problems, that this intermediary could in fact make good.
So if the requirement is that derivatives be traded on a clearinghouse that's, I guess, sort of would be managed by all of the those who deal in these, is there a difference in the amount of public disclosure, how much information the public gets about these?
Well, you ask a very shrewd question. The clearinghouse that is vying for the biggest part of this business is here in New York, and it is called the ICE Trust, I-C-E Trust. And it is a an entity that's relatively new, but it trades other commodities. But it is very closely affiliated with the major dealer firms who trade derivatives in very big size. And so another concern that some have is that those dealers will be able to sort of control how much disclosure there is on this ICE clearinghouse. And they might be able to say, oh, well, this should be traded privately. It's really not, remember, one of those plain vanilla contracts. And so they might be able to influence such decisions, which really do have a bearing on the amount of scrutiny that the public will have on these kinds of transactions.
You know, at the risk of getting too technical, I want to ask you one question about what you just said a moment ago about the unlikelihood that the government will be able to regulate these custom derivatives because they are so arcane and intricate, and how could you trade them? It seems to me that, I mean, if it's a political problem that you won't be able to get that through because there's such opposition, that's one thing. But it seems to me that you could simply require them to be disclosed. I mean, there are certain, for example, certain loans such as mortgages which are publicly on file in every city in the country. Can't we at least make the extent and terms of these contracts public, even if they can't be traded like, you know, shares of Walmart?
I think, Dave, you are absolutely right, and it's very, very astute. Disclosure and lack of disclosure is really at the heart of so much of this crisis that we've been through and that we continue to go through. The disclosure of mortgages in pools of securities that were defaulting, the lack of disclosure about off-balance sheet entities and obligations of our major banks, which were not disclosed, which had to come back onto the balance sheet, and so therefore, you know, were directly related to their, you know, huge losses and difficulties. So disclosure is absolutely crucial here. And so, yes, I think that that is a terrific answer to their allegations that these things cannot be traded. Well, let's just shine the light of day on them, and at least people will know the kinds of obligations are out there and who's making them and who's agreeing to them.
Now, how have the banks and others who write and trade derivatives responded to these threats of regulation?
they have responded by, getting together and forming a coalition or a consortium, actually, which they are using as a lobbying entity to try to get their point across to Congress. They have hired some of the same people are working together on this project that worked on it in 2000. And they're spending an awful lot of money to make sure that derivatives will continue to be as profitable to them as they have been up until now.
They're spending money on campaign contributions, lobbyists?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Their lobbyist is a person named Edward Rosen, who is an expert on derivatives, and he led the charge for the banks back in 2000 when Brooksley Bourne of the CFTC lost her battle to regulate derivatives. And he's back and, is a very formidable force and figure and lobbyist. And this is a consortium of about 9 major dealers, major banks, both foreign and domestic, who are very huge participants in the credit default swap market.
And maybe this goes without saying, but I'm assuming that a lot of these same banks who are spending money on campaign contributions and lobbyists to protect derivatives are some of the same banks that got billions in federal bailout money.
Yes. These banks actually formed their consortium just about a month after 5 of them received billions of dollars in TARP money. That's a paradox that I think is intriguing.
What's their case? I mean, what's the argument that derivatives ought to continue to operate in the shadows?
Their argument is that AIG was a rogue operator, that apart from AIG, credit default swaps have not produced problems in world markets, that in fact they have helped corporations and large investors hedge positions, reduce their risks. You know, these are the arguments that you always hear. There really aren't any different from any of the other arguments that you have heard for decades about why regulation is bad. You know, if these things are regulated, these people say jobs will disappear. They will go to Europe or somewhere else overseas. Profits will decline. You know, the corporations will no longer be able to hedge their positions. You know, they're focusing a lot on the hedging aspect of it, not really so much on the speculative nature of these things, which far, far outweighs the hedging that credit default swap customers do.
You know, the banks, you know, a lot of the banks are getting together to oppose further regulation of derivatives. But they were really harmed by this financial crisis also. Why would they want to preserve the status quo?
Well, the derivatives business that these banks do is very profitable. In fact, it's one of their few profitable enterprises at the moment. And it's helping to offset, you know, massive amounts of losses. So they're just trying to protect one of their, you know, one of their very, very sort of big honeypots and a last one, as it were. I mean, you know, they do have other profitable areas, but derivatives are hugely profitable. So that's one reason. But, you know, yes, the banks were hurt mightily by this mess. But, hey, they brought us to the brink. They pushed us over the edge. And their shareholders have paid the price. The taxpayers have paid the price. The employees have paid the price. But I'm not sure the executives who are, on the scene making decisions and the boards of these companies have paid the price.
Are derivatives still profitable in this kind of economic climate where, you know, defaults loom around every corner?
Yes, they are still profitable because the person who is constructing these deals, the intermediary, the dealer who sells them, is still able to capture enormous profits because they're still being kept under wraps. There still is no market that says, here is what an investor or a buyer should pay for that particular credit default swap. It's still kept under wraps. And one of the reasons that the large dealer firms who have been trading these derivatives, selling them to their clients, want to keep them under wraps is because the profits in privately traded credit default swaps are far, far larger than the profits will be when the customers can see what others are paying for those similar transactions and what other dealers are charging for those similar transactions.
Huh. So if you sell a credit default swap, someone is purchasing, betting on, insuring some bond by some company. If that bond goes bust, and I've written that credit default swap, I assume I'm going to take a huge loss, right?
Yes, but the bank is not necessarily the person who's writing it. The bank who wants the dealers who want derivatives to continue to be traded, in the shadows are the facilitators. They're the people who make the transactions happen. They're the people who put together the company that's writing the insurance with the buyer of the insurance, and that's where their profits lie.
Hmm. And so the companies that are actually writing the insurance, they're not the ones that want to continue this stuff?
Well, they are to some degree, but it's really more about the people who are acting as the intermediaries in this market, the facilitators, that step in to devise these kinds of transactions, sell them to their customers, and pocket the profits on those transactions. It's just a fee-based business. It just so happens that the fees are sizable because it's an obscure market. It's not a market where everyone knows what a credit default swap with this particular entity should cost.
So, AIG bet way too much mm-hmm. on these derivatives, on these credit mm-hmm. default swaps, and then got into terrible
essentially
trouble.
They were essentially betting that mortgages were not going to default.
Right. And so they got into mm-hmm. terrible trouble, and the taxpayers mm-hmm. had to bail them out. And mm-hmm. if you have all these financial players out there continuing to write these credit default swaps in the shadows in an unregulated environment, and another coming calamity occurs. I mean, whether it's commercial real estate or a credit card, and a bunch more of these bets go bad, what happens? I mean, are they going to come back to the taxpayers again?
Absolutely they will. I mean, have we not learned that when these banks get in trouble, if they go to daddy, they'll get what they want? I mean, that's the lesson that we have unfortunately learned from this mess, that, the kid took the convertible, went on a joyride, drove it off the cliff. He survived. The convertible didn't. And goes back and says, hey, Dad, I want a new car. And Dad says, okay, here's the money.
Any chance the government might say sorry?
We've set such a precedent here for bailing out everybody. It seems impossible to imagine that a large participant of any market that might have a big impact, if it failed, would not be bailed out.
Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, is a student of the Depression, and it seems that he believes that an important lesson of that catastrophe was that you have to maintain confidence in the banking system, that once there are runs on banks, that calamity follows. Has he drawn the right lesson here?
Well, certainly confidence is crucial to, the kind of open and fair operating of markets. But I would argue that we have not built confidence by the way we have approached these failures. In fact, there's been a sort of a sense that the government was picking winners and losers without any kind of a playbook. We arranged a marriage of Bear Stearns with J.P. Morgan when Bear was about to fail, but we let Lehman Brothers go. Then 5 minutes later, we bail out the world's largest insurance company, which was not even overseen by the Fed or any bank regulators. So, that is not the kind of operation that instills confidence. And in fact, you have to wonder about the idea that these regulatory actions, that have sort of kept some of the larger banks afloat, like Citigroup, I would argue that that does not necessarily instill confidence. I think what confidence is created by is a clarity of the problem, is a sense that people understand where we are, how financially sound or unsound these institutions are. And from my view, we've just been sort of papering over their problems or allowing them to sort of do the least toughest thing that they can do to raise capital. It's been, I think, a very easy, sort of too easy set of actions taken by regulators, not tough enough. And I think that that has led to a sort of feeling that we're not sure where we stand. And if we had been a little bit more aggressive and clear about companies that really should not be allowed to go on, then you'd have confidence come back far quicker than you will now.
Gretchen Morgenson, thanks so much for your time.
Anytime, Dave.
Gretchen Morgenson is a business and finance columnist for The New York Times. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, comedian and actor Ed Helms, is known to TV audiences as a former correspondent for The Daily Show and for his current role on the NBC comedy The Office, where he plays the jocular and clueless Andy Bernard. But Helms is also on the big screen these days, starring in the new comedy The Hangover. It's about four guys who go to Las Vegas for a bachelor party and wake up to discover their hotel suite trashed, the groom missing, and their memories of the evening blank. Starring with Helms are Bradley Cooper and Zach Galifianakis. In this scene from the film, the three are at breakfast. Helms' character Stu is wondering why he's missing a tooth and can't bear the thought of Jägermeister, the booze they'd been guzzling the night before. The three friends are trying to figure out what happened and where the groom, Doug, is.
I looked everywhere. Gym, casino, front desk, nobody's seen Doug. He's not here.
Okay. All right, let's just track this thing. All right, what's the last thing we remember doing last night?
Well, the first thing was we were on the roof and we were having those shots of Jaeger.
And then we had dinner at the Palm, right?
That's right. And then we played craps at the Hard Rock, and I think Doug was there.
That sounds right. No. He definitely was.
What is this?
Oh, my God. That is my tooth. Why do you have that? What else is in your pocket?
No, this is a good thing. No, check your pockets. Check your pockets. You have anything?
I have an ATM receipt from the Bellagio. 1105 for $800.
What's on your arm?
Bill, you were in the hospital last night.
I guess so, yeah.
You okay?
Yeah, Alan, I'm fine.
What the hell is going on?
Ed Helms, welcome to Fresh Air. This film, The Hangover, is about four guys going to Las Vegas for a bachelor party, or at least a guy's night out before one of you goes for a wedding. Have you done the bachelor party thing? Is this a familiar experience to you?
I have. Sure. I've been on a few bachelor outings, and I don't know. It's funny. A lot of people ask, what's the craziest bachelor party you've been to? And I've never been on a really crazy bachelor party, and I think that they're mostly not crazy. Even if all the intentions are to get crazy, you just have a disparate group of guys that don't know each other, and it usually winds up being a little bit anticlimactic.
Right. Well, now your character in this, Stu, is kind of the nerd of the group. He's a dentist. Can't even.
Resemble that remark.
Okay, do you? That's,
yes.
That's more like Ed Helms would be at one of these things.
Yeah, no, that's fair to say. He is the he's the archetypal sort of nervous Nelly of this movie.
In the film, you four guys get a overly extravagantly expensive suite atop Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, and then wake up in the morning remembering nothing, but the scene of the hotel room is just. Well, the suite is just hilarious. Do you want to just describe a little bit of what the wreckage that you and your friends awaken to?
Thank you. I love that scene too, and it really is, I think, a production designer's dream come true. It's somewhere the assignment was given out: figure out as many ways as possible to completely mess up and destroy a hotel suite. And the details, if you really pay attention and look around sort of in the backgrounds of the shots as we wake up that morning, you just see such glorious detail. For example, there is a bowling alley set up with champagne bottles, which cannot end well. There's a card house, miraculously, somehow in this insane party. We managed to erect a very delicate card house. There's just a lot of fun little details.
And you look up and then you see a chicken walking around.
Yeah, of course. Chicken, the universal sign of chaos.
Right, the chicken.
Anywhere you see a chicken, it's chaos.
And then, of course, and this is not giving away too much because this is in the trailer, but when Zach Galifianakis goes to the bathroom to relieve himself, first thing, he looks up and sees a live man-eating tiger. You actually used a real tiger for these scenes. Is that right? What's it like working with a tiger?
Yes, we used a real tiger, and it is crazy to work with a tiger. I feel like you're just buying time when you're working with a tiger. It's only a matter of time before something horrible happens, and there's a little voice in the back of your head that's just saying, stop doing this. Leave. Get away from the tiger.
Were there any particular instructions you got on working around a tiger?
The first day that we worked with the tigers, we got this whole long safety speech. Don't hide behind things because then the tiger will perceive you as prey. Act confident. Act like, you know, don't turn your back on the tiger. Be sure of yourself around the tiger, which is sort of like asking you to fly. It's just like,
right.
You know, and then a lot of sort of just protocol about how the trainers will be handling the tiger, this, that, and the other. Cut to like a half hour later, it was all pretty much out the window. Like everyone just got comfortable. Once the tiger hadn't killed anyone for about a half hour, everyone just got too comfortable. And you had to sort of constantly remind yourself that this is a man-eating creature, and it is a wild animal. So overall, the tiger was exciting, exhilarating, but I still can't shake this feeling that we just got away with something.
You're a dentist in the movie, and when you wake up in the morning, you're missing a tooth. And it looks like you actually stick your tongue into the hole. It looks so real. How do they do that?
Dave, it is completely real. I had an implant when I was a teenager. I lost a tooth, and I had an implant put in. And I hadn't touched it in 20 years. It was perfectly healthy. When we started to kind of try to figure out how to give me a missing tooth, because it was always in the script, we tried a couple of things. We tried to black it out. They made a prosthetic for me that sort of looked like a gap in my teeth, but it actually made the rest of my teeth look like a donkey mouth. So I vetoed that very quickly. And then very reluctantly, I admitted, well, I do actually have an implant here. And Todd was like, oh, great, then we can take it out. And I was like, well, I don't know. And I called my dentist, and he said, you know what? I think we can actually do that. So my dentist, who is a great guy and actually came to the premiere, took it out, and I was toothless there for 3 months while we shot the movie, and then I got a nice new implant.
Wow, you really were made for this role, weren't you? God.
Yep.
You're now a regular on the NBC comedy The Office. You play this character, Andy Bernard, and I thought we'd listen to a scene from The Office. This is you and Oscar, who is the accountant, and you're away on a business trip. You have proposed. You surprised everyone by proposing to Angela, one of the characters, who is a particularly sort of severe person. And Oscar, in a moment of kind of inebriated candor, is asking you about that relationship. Let's listen.
If you don't mind me asking.
Anything.
You can ask me anything.
Okay.
I'm your wingman.
It's just that I've sat next to Angela for a very long, very long time.
Righto.
How can anyone stand that woman?
What?
What do you see in her? What do you see in Angela?
What do I see in Angela?
I want to know.
I see through a hard exterior to a little jelly in the middle. She is teaching me to be a better person. She's working really hard on that. And she has the softest skin I've ever seen, and I can't wait to have sex with her.
You haven't had sex?
No.
Are you guys waiting to get married? Or
honestly, I don't know what we're waiting for.
Andy, something is wrong with that woman.
What is wrong with her?
I'd like to know. You should call her and ask her. I'd like to know what's wrong with her.
I should call her and ask her. What is wrong with her?
Do it. It's a caller. Oh, my God. Don't call her. Don't call her, Andy.
Too late. Oh, my God. Too late. It's silent. Now it's ringing.
Hello? Hello?
What is wrong with you?
Why would you do it, Andy?
What?
That's Oscar, and he wants to know why you won't do me, and I think it's a valid question.
Are you drunk?
This is Andy Bernard.
I know who this is.
I want to take you to sex school.
What?
Who is that monkey?
Is somebody there?
Are you drunk?
I have needs.
We will discuss this later.
Naked.
What?
We'll discuss it later naked. I want to see you naked.
And that's our guest, Ed Helms from The Office. Speaking with Oscar Nunez, who plays the accountant, Oscar speaking with Angela. And then the whispering voice there was the other character, Dwight, who Angela is actually cheating on Andy with. It's all so funny and complicated. tell us about this character. He's kind of a hard guy to figure out, Andy Bernard, your guy in The Office.
Yeah, he's a bit of an enigma. He's actually pretty simple when you think about it. He's desperate to be liked. He's very eager to impress, a little bit hot-tempered, but ultimately very earnest and eager to love and wants to share himself with other people.
You know, you did a lot of years of stand-up and sketch comedy where you have an audience and the feedback is live and you know what works and what doesn't. I mean, The Office is so different. I mean, A, because you're in a TV studio, you're not in front of an audience, but it's also that the humor is sort of often in these sort of awkward spaces and silences. Is it kind of harder to know when you've nailed it with that kind of a show?
That's funny because nailed it is one of Andy Bernard's sort of trademark right. lines. But, you know, we laugh a lot on that Office set. And usually the shots, the scenes are pretty quick. So even if there's no laughter in an actual take, if it's a great take, people are laughing right afterwards. And a lot of times people are laughing during takes, myself included. I'm pretty bad at ruining a lot of takes. So there is a lot of laughter. And you can tell on the page when the writers have nailed it. And all you got to do is say it. There's instantaneous feedback, even on a TV set or a movie set.
The other thing that's interesting about Andy Bernard is that it uses another tool in your kit, which is your music. I mean, you sang a cappella and you play the banjo. And there are various points in the series at which
the two most annoying musical forms on earth.
How did that get into the show more? Was that something they just kind of saw you had, or did you ever improvise, just breaking into song?
Yeah, well, that's a great – one of the great things about The Office set is it's so open to improvisation. You really don't need to very often because the writing is so good. But if you're inspired or want to, it's just an open field and you can kind of mess around. So those first eight episodes, the writers endowed Andy with such funny little traits, one of which was being an a cappella singer and obsessed with a cappella music. It just so happens that I, too, Ed Helms, am kind of obsessed with a cappella music. And so I just sort of massaged that character trait and kept bringing it up. I just inject little pieces of music here and there into my lines in very inappropriate places. And so it became this fun sort of symbiotic feedback loop with the writing staff of I would give Andy some trait and then they would play with that and expand it in some way. And with regards to the banjo, the showrunner, Greg Daniels, was just so tickled that I played the banjo and wanted to stick it in the show. What I love about that is that it doesn't make any sense. My character, Andy Bernard, is a preppy Connecticut yacht club kid. Why on earth would he play the banjo? But for some, it's just one of those fun mysteries about Andy Bernard, I guess.
Right. Don't think about it too much.
Right.
Well, we should give the audience a taste here. And I thought we would share this moment from The Office where you're in the break room with Dwight, one of the other characters. Dwight has his guitar, you have your banjo, and you're trying to impress the new receptionist. Let's listen.
Sorry. I like that song. You're good.
You're good.
Thank you.
That was great, but it's just sort of, it's still a little choppy. Like, but don't worry, it's hard. It took me a while, too. It's like, okay.
Wow.
What? Oh, my God, you heard that? I'm so embarrassed. I'm so, like, rusty.
It's good. You're really coming along. It's really technically proficient, but, you know, there's really no heart or soul in it.
Really?
Hey, you want to sing it with me? Almost heaven, West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah.
In German!
Das Leben ist auch dort. Älter als die Bäume, jünger als die Berge. Wohin wie der Wind, take me home. Country road to the place I belong. West Virginia, Mount Mama, take me home. Country road.
Pick it, Andy!
You grew up in Atlanta, right? And went to school at Oberlin in Ohio?
Yeah. That is correct.
Were you the kid breaking up the class in school? Was comedy always a big part of your life?
Comedy has always been a huge part of my life. I was not particularly funny, I don't think, in school. I wouldn't consider myself a class clown by any means. But comedy just was always something I was obsessed with, comedy television and movies. And, you know, when I was 8 years old, I started watching Saturday Night Live, and it was Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo and Martin Short and all those guys. And I didn't even understand it. It was just an energy that I wanted to be a part of. I really think Eddie Murphy's stuff is what sucked me in. I just really wanted to be a part of that.
And you went to New York after college, right, and started just doing sketch comedy and stand-up. How hard was it to get started to make a living, to know that you could do this?
You know, it was hard logistically, but I never questioned it. It was always sort of like just what I had to do, and I was so excited to be in what I thought was sort of the center of the comedy universe. And, you know, going to comedy clubs, and there's Jim Gaffigan right there, you know, one of my stand-up sort of heroes, and or there's Dave Attell. And before long, you know, after a few years, I had sort of carved out an actual place for myself in the New York comedy community. And, you know, looking back, they were maybe sort of lean years and a little tough, but it was so fun and such a exhilarating, optimistic time. And the stakes were very low. No agents or movie makers or deal makers were coming to shows. It was just a bunch of really eager young comedians trying to impress each other and support each other.
So there came a point where you got into a tryout and became a regular on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And I mm-hmm. thought we would listen to a cut from one of your field reports. This is about a small town in Texas that changed its name to get a commercial benefit. I don't know if you remember this one. It was the town of Clark. And in this case, you're interviewing Bill Merritt, who is the mayor of this town of Clark, population 125. And I'll just mention for reasons that will be clear in a minute, that it's hundreds of miles from any coast. Let's listen to you interviewing the mayor.
In recent years, rural communities have suffered as residents have left in favor of places that offer things like stimulation or to do. In the North Texas town of Clark, a sleepy backwater with 125 residents, it has become a matter of survival.
When I first moved here, this town was not a place that people were inclined to move to. There were very few positives, and it was pretty sad.
Really? It looks like you did a great job cleaning up after the hurricane.
No hurricanes hit here.
I looked around. It looks like...
No.
Any mayor could mask a town's flagging appeal by courting industry or tourism. But Mayor Bill had a more innovative solution.
I brought everybody who lives here free satellite service for 10 years.
And all the town had to do in return was change its name from Clark to Dish, as in Dish Satellite TV.
You know, this is very progressive. As you're aware, there's very few people and towns out there that have ever done anything like this.
And while NFL Package Wisconsin and Adult On Demand Missouri might take exception to that, it's clear Bill's initiative has revived the town.
And that's our guest, Ed Helms, on a piece from The Daily Show. And this brings up something that I've often wondered about in these field reports, where you're going out and you're doing a comedy piece on somebody who feels very strongly about whatever they're doing. In this case, he's the mayor of a small town. It might be somebody who has an attachment to a fringe political cause or some obscure product they've invented. And you're there really to poke fun at them. And I'm wondering, do you tell them beforehand, look, I'm going to kind of make some fun of you here, or do you just do it and apologize afterwards, or what? How does that go?
Well, first of all, I want to contextualize that clip a little bit, because the mayor of that town actually sold out that town and was a pretty cynical character. So I would always approach those interviews with it wasn't as much about making fun of person as much as trying to kind of expose some hypocrisy somewhere or make myself look stupid. But to answer your question, no. I mean, we would not prep people for the interviews in any way. But that said, a lot of people obviously are familiar with The Daily Show and had some sense of what we might be up for. This particular guy was just happy to get some publicity for his town, so he would have done anything.
Before we let you go, Ed Helms, I wanted to ask you a couple other things. You do voiceover work for commercials, or did do? Do you still do that for? I mean, you did Burger King and Doritos and stuff.
Yeah, I did when I was doing stand up in New York. That's that ultimately became how I supported myself, was just doing voiceovers for TV commercials. And radio commercials.
Do you have a favorite pitch?
You know, I did hundreds of them, and I can't – they just all sort of blurred together.
Well, it's interesting, because in a lot of your characters, you are often sounding all-knowing and authoritative, but in a way that's kind of over the top and self-mocking.
And ultimately not knowing of anything.
Right. And I wondered if it's ever tempting when you're selling the Whopper to, I don't know, just throw a little irony in there, like, do you really believe this?
No, Dave, I'm a professional. If I'm recording a commercial voiceover, I try to make it sound like I believe in it, whether or not I do, I guess.
All right. I also read that you've sold a comedy pitch for a movie about Civil War reenactors. Is that right?
Yeah.
What's your experience with them?
Well, I just, I grew up in the South, and the Civil War nostalgia is just sort of more present there than elsewhere in the country. So it's always been something that fascinated me. And my writing partner and I just got this idea about Civil War reenactors who get sent back in time to the actual Civil War and have to find their way back. It's sort of a big, crazy Back to the Future, Monty Python kind of kooky, fun movie.
Well, look forward to it. Ed Helms, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ed Helms, you can see him as Andy Bernard in The Office and starring in the new film The Hangover. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, John Myers, and John Sheehan. Singer and rhythm guitarist Marty Gross, no relation to Terry, but he does live in Philadelphia, has a new CD full of not well-known but terrific vintage jazz tunes. We'll close with this one, Pardon Me, Pretty Baby. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.